by Satanic International Network. You're listening to the news.
I'm Mind and Cage, every foul wicked spirit in the host, the news.
20 minutes, that gorilla day, on the news, spread out.
On the news, it's gonna fucking rock. Be there.
The whole point.
To really tap into adversarial time
necessitates a certain fortitude.
Now onto our show.
Thanks for tuning in, folks. I'm TC Downing, and with me on the line is Satanism's own version of Dr. House, Dan Dredd. How you doing, man?
What's going on, Beast? What's going on? How you doing tonight?
I'm doing fantastic, man. Like I was just saying, I just got out of the shower, sitting down, put together a couple ideas of things that I wanted to discuss this evening, and really looking forward to kind of, getting to a good show. I understand we might have to deal with some definitions up front, though. How about you, man? How are you doing?
Oh, fuck, I'm doing fantastic, man. I can't complain. I feel like a million yen. Yeah.
Million. So $50. No, I'm just
About $50,
And, first question in the chat room tonight, we might as well just get this sucker right out of the way. What is Auto Diabolica?
Yeah, that's funny. I've had a few questions about that. Basically, Shakespeare invented words, so can I. It's basically a concept, a word to sort of describe the concept of consciously manifesting as the adversary, not doing it. That's kind of what I've coined as an auto-diabolic method, but the process, the collective doing of it, you know, the fact that it is being done, you know, becoming the adversary itself, and those that do things or ideas that are auto-diabolic in nature, sort of like erotica is, you know, things that are erotic in nature, or Americana are things that are, you know, all things American, distinguishably.
Right on. Well, I suppose we should maybe stop for just a minute and talk a little bit about the process involved in auto diabolica, or how something could be deemed auto diabolic, just so we can make sure to, you know, paint a nice bright red sign out there for everybody.
Well, it's not so much the specifics of the doing, but the intention behind it, you know, to approach things from an adversarial perspective, even if it's something you might believe in, especially if it's something you might believe is true, you know, and try to take the counter position. It's no substitute to actual experience, to actually doing things, but it's an approach to the mind. Whereas, you're always sort of, it's like an immune system for your mind, where it's always attacking and burning away the things that aren't, that don't hold to your own scrutiny and the scrutiny of others. That's why it's good to put your ideas out there and see who might rip them to shreds and see where you're at after that. If you can remain intellectually honest, your ideas will, you know, be refined. And then, you know, you can take that and go out in the real world and test your ideas, find out what your limitations are, and then go out and shatter them. That's pretty much, that's what it means to be auto-diabolic.
So, and to shorten it up, it's basically a method of making sure that you truly understand something before you commit yourself to it. It's kind of feeling out the ground to figure out where the firmest place to stand is.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and realizing that there's pitfalls that, you know, kicking away that shit on top of them and not stepping in them, or, you know, having things presented to you as if they were gold and scratching the surface and realizing that, hey, this isn't gold at all. This is aluminum. You know, whereas a lot of people would just take those things and assume they were gold and run with it. You know, if we're going to talk metaphors.
Right. Well, I think, it's just my opinion that men shouldn't act on anything without knowing or understanding what they're acting on. It's kind of foolish to, you know, step behind the wheel of an 18-wheeler when you've never even driven a go-kart.
Yeah, exactly. But therein lies the problem, right? The knowledge. Like, how do you acquire really real knowledge, true knowledge? I mean, there's a distinct difference between knowing something and knowing of something. You know what I'm saying? And to actually know something, you have to experience it. Like, you have to get behind the wheel of that 18-wheeler the first time before you've never done it to really know what it's like to drive it. Of course, you know, it's not good to do so until you have an understanding of it as well. You know, preparation is key, right? But, yeah.
Right. Well, I think that, you know, to do anything that in a faith-based manner is foolish, but there always has to come that point in which you act a little on faith, and that's different than, you know, having faith. Acting a little on faith, taking a chance, risking something is different than from placing some kind of blind belief, because if you're a truly calculated risk-taker, you've done all the math and kind of weighed the odds out for yourself, and you know you have X percentage of chance of actually succeeding in this thing before you go forward with it. So I'm trying to wrap back here to what the hell I was actually making the point of. That's a very fourth way idea right there. The idea that faith in place of experience is foolishness, and it's something that other quote-unquote gurus out there have tried to portray as being a non-existent fact, but instead it's like one of the core pieces of Gurdjieff's philosophy, and one of my own, thanks to not only Gurdjieff, but LeVay, Ayn Rand, and so forth and so on. I could probably go on with, you know, 1,000 authors of the past that have put up the idea of putting something to the test and trying something, but not doing it in a foolish, reckless manner.
Oh, certainly. And as an aside, just kind of a little sticking point for me is it all depends on how you frame it. You don't really have to frame taking a risk as in a faith-based manner, because you're doing it with awareness, if you're doing it with awareness. If you do something and you fully believe that you're going to get a specific result, even though that you really have no good reason to believe that you're going to get that result, that's faith. If you're going into something that's a calculated risk, and you realize that there's a good chance this might blow up in your face, but you also realize that there's a better chance that it's going to go through for you, you know, that's not really a faith-based decision. That's a calculated risk. I think there's a very important distinguishable difference between these two concepts.
Absolutely. I'm trying to think here now. Well, what were the next thing? I mean, tonight's whole show is really more about walking the sinister path, as you termed it in the past. You know, daring to be your own person, and daring to put these ideas, these things, under scrutiny. And at some point, you know, you're going to, if you're doing it right, get caught up and actually be the bad guy. So.
Actually, that brings me around to another thing that I wanted to address. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about the ONA lately, and there's a lot of misconceptions. The number one misconception I seem to see, you know, that people tend to, you know, see ONA-oriented people as posturing or as pushing towards criminal activity, and that's not really the case. That being sinister isn't about, you know, earning your bad guy badge or, you know, being evil for the sake of being evil. It's about transgressing your own limits, which is not necessarily illegal in all instances. But the thing is that we were raised in and programmed by, you know, a cesspool of Magian ideology and ideas. And as such, being raised in this environment, most of our own limitations correlate to the limitations imposed by that system, which, you know, a lot of the times equate to, you know, our limitations being also the limitations of society. So some things will be illegal. You know, if you want to bust your own limits, sometimes you have to bust the limits of the state as well. But, I mean, there's plenty of sinister activity, you know, that I would define as sinister that's completely legal. I mean, you know, go climb a cliff with no ropes. I did this. I was about 18 years old, and there's about a 100-foot cliff that I was down on the beach. I was working with this guy. We were dragging logs off the beach and cutting them into firewood. And anyway, we're on a break, and we're on the beach smoking a doobie, 18 years old, and we're talking about cliff climbing. And I'm looking at this cliff, and it's about 100 feet. And the first 50 feet look like they're fairly easy to scale. And the last 50, you know, I'm looking at it, I'm thinking, well, I could probably climb that easily. And And Dave, the guy I was with, he's like, no, man, you shouldn't do that. But I did it anyway, right? And I got right to the top, about, I don't know, 8 feet, 9 feet from the top. And then I realized that there's no more handholds, you know. So I get to thinking, like, I look down and I realize there's no way I can climb down. And I look up and there's not really anywhere to go. And I look down to the rocks, you know, crashing on the beach like a fucking movie. And I'm just sitting there for about 15 minutes, just like, you know, in complete terror, not sure what to do. Not sure how to handle the situation. And, you know, my life didn't flash before my eyes, but I knew full well that I might die. And there was a root about, I don't know, what it looked like out of my reach, sort of sticking out of the cliff and then looping around back in, like a thick root. And I just lunged for it, you know. And there was a moment where I was not touching the cliff and I was not touching the root and I was in midair between the two. And that right there was pretty much the most sinister experience that you could imagine, like being on the edge of life and death. Obviously, I caught it because I'm here to tell you the story today.
Well, Dan. Well, I mean, that kind of demonstration or that kind of example that you're presenting there is kind of an extreme version of, I mean, maybe what we don't realize every day, that is that, you know, every time you take an action, there's a certain level of risk involved in it. And the question is if you're willing to, you know, raise the stakes, so to speak. And if you do raise those stakes and are willing to suffer the consequences that come with them, the moments when you're triumphant, you know, it gives you something to really reflect back on. Like, I mean, climbing a 100-foot cliff, and really worst-case scenario, unless you absolutely, you know, landed wrong, worst-case scenario, you get a broken back and you're laid up in the hospital for 6 months or something like that. I don't think that was actually an entirely life-threatening thing, but...
Oh, no, man. I would have died for sure. It was jagged rocks. This is the west coast of Vancouver Island. I don't know if you've ever been there. It was jagged rocks.
No.
It was all bedrock. There was no beach or anything. It was certain death, at least in my mind it was.
Okay. Okay. Well, I mean, regardless, and it's not really important, so to speak. I think this is what I was getting at. It's not really important what the realistic properties, possibilities of you dying was, but was important that it was in your mind, you conceived yourself as being at risk, and that actually was a driving force to propel you to act on that risk and reach for that branch, even though, you know, the odds were stacked completely against you. It's something Sun Tzu talked about a lot. He thought it was a good strategy to put his soldiers back into a corner, you know, the army coming front onto them. I mean, when I read the Art of War and I crossed the section in which they're actually talking about this, I always have a couple moments of like a flash reflection to that movie 300 where they've got them wedged between the two walls of those cliffs, and there's no turning back, there's no running away.
Oh, it's true. Many people do perform under pressure, you know. In an alternate universe, I miss that branch and I'm dead. But, you know, it is what it is, right? But for me, I was addressing more the actions that transgress your own limitations. I mean, what you're talking about can work anywhere within your limitations, you know, responding to risks or taking risks and, you know, assessing your cost to risk ratio and yada, yada, yada. But when it comes to a point where you're doing something that, you know, absolutely terrifies you or makes you really nervous or something that, you know, that you could not picture yourself doing or something that, you know, that really pushes a limit or, you know, something like that, it's a very serious experience, you know. It can alter you in a way that sometimes you can't undo, you know. That's the true nature of the sinister left-hand path, at least as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think maybe you're just slightly misunderstanding the point I was making with the being backed into the corner. The idea is that you're no longer... The idea is that you're no longer certain of the outcome. Well, actually, no, the outcome certainty is usually in the reverse favor. I mean, death is imminent. It's facing upon you. It's pounding down on you. and you have just that one option to push forward past that boundary. And that's what I was talking about. I was talking about the same kind of driving force, just, I guess, from a mildly different perspective.
I agree. I think that's probably wired right into us, right into our animal nature at an instinctual level. You know, that when we're in danger, we can run a little faster, do a little more. You hear these stories about mothers whose children are in danger or whatever, lifting the backs of cars and doing crazy things like this. So, yeah, I mean, in principle, I totally agree with what you're saying.
Right on. And I don't know, I guess that's why I was always interested in the idea that Gurdjieff presented about developing your essence, developing that animal that you were born with. That was one of the things that was really neat to me when I came across it, was that he talked about people in three layers in total, but two that matter in terms of actual, intellectual or intuitive value, and those two are the essence and the personality. The personality being that interface that actually, that's what your shackle is. That's what the collar is. That's what's keeping you, imprisoned. That layer of personality, that thing that knows, okay, if I transgress this rule right here, there's going to be consequences. And so it leads to ideas like political correctness and moral high ground and stuff like that.
Yeah, I guess that's what Anton Long might have described as the difference between, causal and acausal. Your causal forms being the things that you believe in, the structures, the sort of structures you build in your mind for yourself, or that are built, for you, but ultimately still by yourself. Whether or not you accept someone else's ideas as your own, or whether you create them yourself, you're still doing it yourself. But most people construct their own prison for their mind.
Yeah. They certainly do. I would say they go so far as not only construct their own prison, but they're playing an intricate part in the construction of prisons for other people. I don't know what it is about humans, but we've got to stop and start a train wreck. And at the same point, I'll give you a good example. I now live in a duplex, whereas prior to this, I was living in a second-story apartment. The neighbors behind me have a bunch of little ruglets, whatever the fuck you want to call them.
Spawn.
They spend more time looking into my windows than they do actually playing. It is the weirdest thing. These kids range from, 3 or 4 years old all the way up into their later teens, and they all stare into my windows.
What you have there is a family of peeping Toms.
It's something. It's something for sure. I'm stopping here real quick, but we actually have we've got a caller on Skype, 1111 number. I'm hoping that it's not our troll, but
I'll put him on.
Let's go ahead and see. Caller, you're on the news.
Hello, caller. Hello.
1111.
Are you talking to me?
Yes.
I guess so. I guess we are. Yes, we are.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Could you introduce
yourself?
And who
might this be?
It's Medus.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Hello. I'm on Skype. Really? I'm calling from my cell phone.
it's showing up as well. It's all one. So I assumed it was Skype, but I guess it's maybe because your cell phone's out of the country?
I guess so, yeah. Now I forgot what we were talking about. I'm fucking up the radio show.
Well, we were talking about all things sinister and all things auto-diabolic and, of course, the fourth way, that being beast side of the coin, of course.
Okay, well, sorry, can we just do a recap of what we just talked about? Like, I had something to say, and then it just totally just left my brain, because I didn't know that you guys were talking to me. I thought that there was some mystery Skype person that was before me.
No, you are the mystery Skype person. Well, what I was talking about before you called in was I sort of gave the definition of sinister as it applies to me, you know, and how it's not necessarily doing things that are illegal, that, you know, it's just they're not synonyms. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't, you know. Go out and defy some social conventions, go get into a fight, go and, you know, there's lots of things that you can do that aren't necessarily illegal that will test your own limits. So anyway, that's basically what I was talking about.
And for me, I was actually talking about the fact that people are building other people's prisons by looking into their windows, like my Peeping Tom neighbors over here.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, we all construct our own reality, right? So, I mean, like, if you think you're living in a prison or in hell or whatever, then, like, that's what you're living in, and you'll draw that kind of attention towards you, you know, whether it be negative or positive. But, you know, like, if you live, like, in your own paradise, and I know that it's all subjective, like, you know, one person's prison's another person's paradise and vice versa, but, you know, like, I don't know, it's difficult. Well, again, like, it's like on the whole good bad thing, like, it's hard to pinpoint what actually, like, what means what and to what extent, you know?
Exactly, but that's the thing. You've already come to a lot of conclusions that allow you certain freedom. You know, most people will believe what is good and what is bad, you know, like, you should know right from wrong at this age. You know, who doesn't hear that when they're a child? As if, like, there's some, you know,
but
right and wrong.
But what is right and what is wrong, you know? Like, it's,
exactly.
I don't know. I don't think it's so black and white. There's a huge gray zone.
See, that's the point. That's where you've come further, obviously, than, you know, than a lot of people. Because a lot of people are stuck with that. That means you've transgressed that. You know, you've transgressed that idea of right and wrong somehow.
I don't know, like, I've always been really, like, to quote Ghostbusters, like, really fuzzy on the whole good, bad thing, you know, because when I was little, like, you know, I was told that I was a rotten kid, and at the same time, I was told that I was a great kid by all my friends' parents, you know, so, like, I don't, like I said, it's hard to nail that way.
Well, really, good and bad are just ways, people's ways of telling you if they like something or if they don't like it, you know. Under the guise sometimes of being objectively right and wrong, but there is no objective right and wrong. There is no moral high ground to take. It's just kind of a position people use against each other, you know, just another weapon in the war of, you know, social dynamic.
Which I guess kind of wraps back around to what I was talking about and the example I was using of my neighbors, that other people become very concerned with what other folk... that people become concerned with what other people are actually doing, and they try to impose that sense of moral high ground, like Dan was just suggesting.
Well, it only makes sense, right? Once you believe that there is a moral high ground and that something is, you know, objectively written into the universe as being true or objectively right, then you're going to want everyone else to be doing that too, because you believe in right and wrong, so you're going to, you know, obviously you're going to be on the side of right.
But, like, even take ritual work, for example, like, you know, even, like, LaVey comments on this and saying that, you know, if the person is deserving of it, then, you know, like, it goes that way. And, you know, like, your curse or whatever the fuck else is, or pardon my French, but whatever else is going to, you know, like, will go through adequately. And in my experience, that's true. But provided that, you know, that whole thing is, like, you know, is true, then... if, you know, like, if it's meant to be, then wouldn't that be right, even if you're doing harm to somebody else? And that in itself is just an extreme contradiction, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you can define right and wrong as, like, right as being what is true and wrong as being what isn't true. That's as good of definition as any. I mean,
but
if you
what
think
is true? Like, what textbooks tell us?
No, it's what is true is what you can experience for yourself and the information you can extrapolate, you know, for yourself from that, you know, truth is a very subjective thing. You can say that, you know, it's true that the sky is blue, but blue is still just a subjective thing that we all share based on our sensory, you know, stimuli.
No, of course, because there are people who are, like, colorblind and stuff like that. But, like, you know, take, you know, history, for example, like, you learn, well, I learned about, you know, Canadian history and whatever, like, grades 4 and 8, and it was boring as shit, but, you know, like, I'm taking from what I learned from my teacher and what I see written in the textbook as being, you know, quote unquote true. And, you know, like, maybe it always necessarily isn't. Like, I've thought a lot about, you know, maybe 15 or 20 years from now when 9/11 is probably going to be written into a textbook somewhere and what's going to be said, like, on, you know, that whole subject. Like, not to bring that up as, like the main focus or whatever, but just as an example, what we're told, whether, you know, like, whatever form of media or, you know, media it is, whether it's, like, printed press or the news or whatever else, like, it's completely biased, and it's, you know, like, what can we even really, like, perceive to be true in the first place?
See, that's it. You know, I'm a big skeptic of the history that we're presented and information that we're presented, because I full well realize that people do things with their own agenda in mind, in, like, almost 100% of the time. You know, whether they be politicians, they get that power for their own good. You know, it's always the victors that write the history. What do you think World War II history would look like right now if the Germans had won? What kind of monsters would Americans be portrayed as? You know, what kind of monsters would the Brits be portrayed as? You know, it's common knowledge that the Germans had, you know, death camps and whatnot, and they had concentration camps. But it's not so well known that also in America there was internment camps for Japanese people, in which many Japanese people died. But you don't hear about that shit in American, you know, history textbooks, right?
No, exactly. No, not really. And, like, even to further, like, put it into, like, a different frame, like, think about, you know, the Americans or Canadians or whoever that were in Japan during World War II, you know, like, how were they treated? Like, was there, you know, some kind of camp for them? Like, were they, like, I don't know, I don't even know the word, but were they, like, separated into their own little, I don't know, compound or whatever?
You know what? I've never, I really don't know thing one about that, the treatment of Allied citizens in Japan. I don't know. That's a good question, though. That's something I'm going to have to research.
I brought that up in actually my history class in, like, grade 10 or 11, and it was, like the ending question on some essay that I wrote, and my teacher, like, because the last line of my essay was something like, you know, how were Canadians or Americans treated in Japan at the same time, or in any of these places, and my teacher just wrote a bunch of question marks, and I got a C-. And it's like, what? Really? Okay.
It's not part of the curriculum. You're not supposed to know that. I'm of the opinion, you know, I have a lot of opinions, obviously. I'm of the opinion that the education system is kind of rigged to push you in a certain direction, to push you into the system and then get a job and buy a house and become in debt and, you know, contribute to the wheel, you know, and keep things rolling. It kind of pushes you in that direction. And when you start asking things and doing things that don't really jive with that, especially school teachers, because they have very specific training, you know, if it's not the curriculum, the chances are they don't know the answer.
Yeah, exactly. And rather than admit that, they'd rather just, you know, say that you're out of line or what you're saying is inadequate. And I can't even count how many teachers I've had that I've been in this situation with, not just with this example, but generally, like I've said before, you know, like, I always argue the opposite. It doesn't matter what the hell I'm talking about or if I even agree with what it is I'm saying, but if there is a general opinion and then, you know, the other side of it's never touched, I'll touch the other side, and that's when I get fucking, you know, nailed.
That is what I'm talking about when I talk about autodiabolica. People that just naturally do that. The essence, that flow. That is, thank you. That really cemented that.
I want to interject here real quick and kind of put my two cents in on the whole teacher concept. I'm of the opinion that the word teacher is a mislabel for what these folks actually do. The term should be conformer.
Conditioner.
Or programmer.
Yeah, programmer. Yeah, exactly. That's how I feel too. You know, they've been put through this system and they have this certain meme set about how things are supposed to be, and then it's their job to put that into the next generation. It's largely the role that the church used to serve, but now we have public education serving a lot of the same functions as the old school church, you know, keeping people believing certain things within certain, you know, limits and having that be the norm and having that, you know, be the right way, if you know, as opposed to the wrong way.
Right. And the thing that's interesting to me about that is, you know, the old saying, if you never make any mistakes at all, then you've never done anything. I think that holds really true. You've got to not be afraid of, from time to time, actually really being wrong.
Being wrong is the greatest victory of all. Because once you're wrong, you've ejected something that you were holding as true previously, and replacing it with something better, something more accurate. Every time you're wrong, you grow. I love to be wrong. You know, it never happens anymore. But no, I'm kidding. It happens all the time.
It's weird to think about, like, with the same teachers that teach us whatever it is that we're, like, taught in school, you know, like, obviously they're each their own person, and it makes you think, like, you know, maybe they think the same way that we do, but, you know, they're forced to teach, or whatever verb you want to use, a certain way, because that's, you know, what they have to do in order to make their money, just like everyone else who fucking hates their job, you know, and it makes you think.
That is actually one of the key, in my opinion, memes that holds things together, that makes the machine keep running, you know, the sort of idea that, well, I'm just doing my job, you know. Like, you know, cops will say that, well, I'm just doing my job.
Yeah,
I don't agree with the state,
I've
but
heard
I'm,
that
just, I'm just doing my job, you know. Or, you know, I'm, you know, doing things reprehensible. No, I'm just doing my job, you know, like soldiers killing other people. Like, they don't agree with killing or whatever, but no, they're just doing their job, you know. It's that exact thing that keeps, you know, that keeps people in slavery. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and it's really funny because you, like, look at, like, the songs they sing in church and shit, and, like, Onward Christian Soldiers, like, that in itself, in my opinion, is an oxymoron. Like, Christian soldiers, really? Like, isn't that in itself saying, like, exactly what the church doesn't want us to do, being a soldier? Because being a soldier doesn't entail just being, like, you know, super stand-up and whatever else, you know? Like, there's, you know, quote-unquote sin involved in being a soldier, you know?
Oh, well, if you were to start unwinding the contradictory nature of the Bible, not just the Bible, but, the, you know, the Christians that practice it and, you know, don't practice it, and how it's interpreted and reinterpreted in the, you know, copious layers of exegesis and eisegesis, which basically means either, you know, inventing meaning out of it or reading meaning into it that you pretty much invent for yourself, then the shit that people are doing nowadays calling Christianity has nothing to do with what the Bible says. You know?
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, of course.
I mean, what the Bible says is bullshit, too, but the way that it's interpreted, like, if the character Jesus were to appear in conservative Christianity in the Bible Belt, he would be the first to get fucking ostracized. You know, he's the opposite of what those guys like.
But Jesus was a human, provided he was, like, a real person and whatever else. Like, I'm sure someone at some point, like, this person was, like, this person's character was based on that's, you know, like, taught or whatever. Like, it's, like, the guiding light for all of these people in the Christian faith. But, like, you know, at one point or another, Jesus was human, just like me or anyone else. And, you know, had the same everything else, like the same instincts, the same feelings, the same emotion, the same, you know, like all of the deadly sins. Of course, Jesus felt all of those. And it's just, I don't know, it's retarded. Because he's made out to be this martyr who, you know, is like the epitome of good and all this other stuff. But really, he's just like anyone else is. So really, like, Jesus could be fucking Russell Crowe, you know, he could be fucking anyone.
Well, it's like you were talking about earlier, you know, you can't even contrast contemporary history as early as 50 years ago. If you really look into Christian history, you realize that there probably was no person matching the description of gospel Jesus. And the fact that, you know, the Pauline epistles were written before the Gospels. The Gospels were written well after Jesus would have been dead, and the authors can't be identified. Yada, yada, yada. They mirror the stories much older of Krishna, Horus, all Osiris, all these other stories. It's pretty easy to tell that, you know, Jesus as we know him from the New Testament is a compilation. He's an assembly. He's Frankenstein. But as for, like, who actually started that movement, I mean, Paul was writing his epistles to somebody, you know. who knows? It's hard to say. If there was a Yahushua, he was probably a conservative rabbi of some kind, with some kind of following. But it's hard to say at this point, you know. The history is so vague.
Yeah, well, like I said, like, Jesus could be anybody. I don't know. Maybe he did exist, like, because, you know, healing powers aren't, you know, a complete fairy tale. Like, there's, you know, people who practice chi and all this stuff, and I've seen it. Like, I've seen someone fucking start a fire with their own hands just by, you know, like, exerting energy. I've had, like, when I briefly took Kung Fu, my Sifu, I had a migraine one day. I used to get really bad migraines, and he just put his hands around my head for, like, a minute, and he had this crazy force field of energy that just got rid of my headache, you know? I believe that those powers are indeed true, and, like, they, because I've experienced them myself, but, so I don't think that the idea that Jesus was, like, a healing, someone who could heal, like, that's, maybe that is true, and I'm inclined to believe that at some point in time or another that maybe this person did exist, but whether he's this perfect whatever being, well, I mean, like, what is perfect, but provided he is this person, it's, like, for him to be this perfect being, like, that in itself is impossible, which, like, you know, I don't, fuck, I'm kind of rambling, but yeah.
Well, he was described more as a spiritual force by Paul in his epistles, and even in the Gospels themselves, he doesn't make the claim of being God, although you can interpret one from the last
of the Mark. Well, he's the Lamb of God or whatever the fuck.
Oh, you have to go to Revelation for that, and Revelation is just a crazy fucking acid trip, but anyway.
Revelations is an awesome story.
All right, Beast, you still there, buddy?
Yeah, I'm still here, man. I'm was just fooling around trying to get this Skype thing working so I can put my headset on and relax a little bit. So hang on just one quick second, man.
All right, buddy, all right. So, yeah, where were we? Talking about fucking the New Testament and shit. How the fuck did we get distracted all the way over to there from what we were talking about before? I don't even know.
Because I go off on tangents, that's why.
So we've actually gone so far down this road that I don't even remember at which point we veered off this fork of the road.
Well, originally it was like the idea that the people who teach us may themselves, you know, have similar beliefs to the ones that we have, but are just... you know, doing their job, so to speak.
Ah, yes. And then I went off on that little tangent about blah, 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 blah. Yes, anyway. Welcome back, Beast.
Thanks, man. I finally got this thing working right, I think. Is there an echo?
No, you sound good.
All right, excellent. Something I wanted to bring up in the actual content of the show is an idea that you and I both share. And one that Gurdjieff shared as well, and that idea is the idea of intentional suffering, placing yourself at odds. I mean, I guess we kind of touched on that a little bit with the being backed up against a mountain and the example with the cliff, but I thought that it would be a good thing to explain that, you know, this doesn't necessarily have to be the end-all, be-all of risk-taking every time you're doing it, but rather that you should be doing it in small successions with everything that you do in life. You should constantly be testing your limits. That's, I think, one of the most beautiful things about children and something that we lose as an adult.
I agree completely. I agree completely. And, shit. Hold on a second.
Sure.
Well, to kind of interject, I mean, something that is lost when we go from being a child to being an adult, which, like, that gap of time is, you know, becoming shorter and shorter and shorter, is, you know, being, like, well, I mean, to quote, I don't remember the author that wrote the book, and I think I brought this up on Tiny Chat the other day, was the journey from innocence to experience, you know, and like, you know, children are growing up a lot faster and, you know, in some way or another, claiming to understand and be aware of things that they may not actually understand or be aware of, you know? So that in itself is like a separate almost status quo, but like for like the younger generation, I guess, you know, which I guess in like at the end of the day really amounts to the status quo of like everybody. But do you see what I'm saying, kind of? Does that make any sense?
I think so, yeah. I'm trying to put the
pieces... I get what you were saying. Sorry, go ahead, Beast.
I was just saying I'm trying to put the pieces together, so if you wanted to clarify a little bit, that'd be fine. But, Dan, if you got it, then I'm sure that you could probably remix it too. And...
Well, but before I got distracted, what you were talking about from Gurdjieff is the idea of pathe mathos, which is the Greek idea of wisdom through suffering. And basically, it's a big idea in O&A too, which is walking the left-hand path through, the human mind will defend its ideas, you know, from itself. You'll jump through rational hoops to defend ideas that you have, and it's very hard to change your own mind through thinking, you know. And the idea of pathe mathos is, you know, that only through, you know, adversity and through things that shock your system, things that... you know, that cause suffering on some level, it will, you know, change your mind or refine your ideas in any meaningful way, or, you know, or in the most meaningful way. And I think that's a correlation there between the fourth way and maybe O&A stuff.
It's one of the things that I thought was there. Another thing Gurdjieff talked a lot about was being there in the moment, actually really truly being in everything that you're doing. You know, we spend so much time doing things as kind of like a mechanical reaction, but that we don't actually realize, you know, the little quirky things that develop around those things. And, you know, so I think that's a pretty strong point to put out there too. It's something that most people should struggle towards. If you're always living in that moment, if you're always focusing on the experience that you're having, you'll gain so much more from having that experience than what you'd pick up the first time around. I mean, there was this old expression that used to get passed around in my circle of friends as a teenager, and that was, if you always do what you've always done, you always get what you've always got. So
that is the truth, my friend. Actually, I picked that bit of... I completely agree. I picked that up from the Tao of Jeet Kune Do a long time ago. I forget exactly what the quote was. Bruce Lee was a very smart individual. You know, basically pertaining to always cultivate awareness. This is a little meme, cultivate awareness. Always cultivate awareness at all times. And this is something that's always been with me. You know, like always try to pay attention to what's going on around me. Not just in front of me, but beside me, to know what's going on around me at all times. I find this is very important, not just for, like, you know, keeping your mind aware, but also, you know, when you're out and about, it's just good to know what's going on around you. Like, consciously do this. It's very easy just to focus or drift off, you know what I'm saying?
Right on.
Well, I mean, like, you have to protect yourself. So being aware of your surroundings is, of course, important all the time, because to... You know, well, like I said, like for self-defense or whatever else, for like to protect yourself, because to keep your mental stability and to be comfortable in where you are mentally and remain that way, like you have to be, you know, aware and more or less comfortable with what's going on around you, awareness especially.
Yes, and it's very, very easily said, but not always that easily done. Sometimes it's work, you know. That's why it's something that's consciously done, or should be consciously done, if you care, which I do. You know, I like to stay aware at all times. It's not always easy, but and I find it's good. It cultivates thinking too. It keeps your mind sharp.
To kind of move the idea of awareness to a deeper level, one of the things that I have particularly noticed about being in the moment or being aware of what's going on is that it gives you the ability to actually slow time down. It's something that I kind of picked up on as I waited for those last 2 or 3 minutes of each period to end so that I could go smoke a joint, you know, outside before I had to get to my next class. It always seemed like those last 2 or 3 minutes would last an eon, where the hour prior to that was nothing. It was just a few minutes.
But a few minutes is totally everything, and I can totally relate because when I was in high school, like, I used to row, and I used to have to wake up at, like, 3:45 in the morning to, you know, be up and get my shit together and be down by the lake, and I'd wake up at, like, 3:40 as opposed to, like, 3:45, and knowing that I had that 5 minutes, it felt like I got an extra night's sleep, you know?
Time's a funny thing in the way we perceive it. You know, I noticed I used to do Kung Fu for a really long time. I did Wing Chun Kung Fu. And I noticed that, like, things will seem very fast until you really focus in and you're aware of what it is they're going to do and the techniques they're going to use. And it all seems to slow down to a point where you can handle it quite easily and just relax. But it's all a matter of how you perceive it. Like, time is really just this sort of fictional construct. It's just how we are aware of, you know, the deterministic nature of things happening in order. And how we perceive that isn't necessarily written in stone.
Well, yeah, no, of course, because, like, we as humans, like, experience time in one way, but, you know, like, dogs and cats and other animals, like, even something as little as, like, you know, like a protist or something else experiences time in a completely different way. So time is really just a bunch of shit.
Yeah, well, it's useful for us. You know,
it's not something you can really peg.
Yeah, it's useful as a gauge for us, but really it's an abstract concept. I mean, how do you know that a tree doesn't experience its entire growth cycle the same way that we experience a week? You know, you don't know. It doesn't matter. Do they experience time, or is time just something that exists in the human brain? Or it's just a lot of theory. I don't really think it matters that much.
No, I don't think so either.
I will kind of actually point to something and just say that it's a suspicious coincidence that it occurs this way. One of the things that's notable to me about people of Asian descent is the length of time in which they actually live in comparison to the rest of the world. And I sometimes often wonder, because it's popular over there to work on your concentration and work on your awareness, and it's just something that's fabricated into the culture over there, that if that doesn't actually have something to do with stretching the actual lifespan of that person.
Well, it's that, you know, probably does have something to do with it. You know, Kung Fu masters tend to live to an old age, you know what I'm saying? But it's also the fact that Asians tend to have smaller bodies and they tend to eat less, you know, carbohydrates and beef and Big Macs.
Yeah, you would think that, but I've spent some time over there, man, and I've got to say that their everyday diet isn't exactly what I would put as being the picture diet that you would find in GNC magazine or something.
Deep fried everything? I don't know. I've never been to China. I can't tell you.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of stuff's deep fried. The way that it's prepared is oftentimes whatever they can actually put into there. You know, if they're wealthy, they can afford to trim the fat. But if they're not, man, then, you know, they need all the nourishment they can get, whether it's good or bad or beneficial or not.
That's survival.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just a peculiar thing. Because I would agree about the smaller body thing, and you would think, I mean, we get the idea that, you know, rice and vegetables and, you know, less meat and all that good stuff is a more healthy way of eating, but it really is a lot of how it's prepared.
I would say martial arts, too, probably. Martial arts is a big thing. You know, Tai Chi, Kung Fu, things you can do into your old age that keep your body, tip-top. Which, older people here tend to just sit around and get fat and watch TV. So there's that, too.
Right. Oh, I would agree with that. And as a matter of fact, I would point to the fact that that's them focusing on their body.
Yeah. Oh, I would completely agree with that. It's an act of will, you know, and keeping the body and the mind together strong, long life. That's my theory anyway. Hopefully I'll be able to tell you about it in 50 years.
But, you know, just food for thought there, man. I mean, because if they're frying up their vegetables in dog lard so that they've got some kind of oil to go on it, you know, I highly doubt that that's, you know, as healthy as some of the, I don't know what I want to call it, biochemically grown stuff that we deal with now.
Yeah, fair enough, fair enough. You know, maybe it doesn't have anything to do at all with your diet. I really don't know. But I mean, it's a good theory. The fact that they, you know, they focus, you know, cultivate qi. Because I don't know if you've ever done any Chinese martial arts, but like I say, I did Wing Chun Kung Fu for a long time, and the idea of qi is very useful. Whether or not I believe in the actual energy behind it, the idea of qi as a focal point in your mind for being able to generate a lot of force, or be able to withstand a lot of force, or be able to do certain things that you would think that would be impossible, or at least very unlikely, it's a very useful thing for that. Like, the idea of qi is very real and very powerful. Whether or not it's energy or not, I don't know, but it works.
It definitely is energy. I mean, like I said, the brief time that I took Kung Fu for, like, I was told that, you know, people spend, you know, their whole lives running around looking for a grab on this energy that I just felt. And, like, that's why my sifu, like, I didn't even have to pay for my friggin' class, because he saw that, like, in me. And that wasn't, you know, if it was, like, a, you know, a political thing, then I still would have had to pay and whatever the hell else. But, like, he, you know, saw that in me. And like I said before, he was someone who had it himself and was able to perform almost miracles just with his, like, just with his hands, you know?
I think there's a tremendous amount.
Like, there's something to it.
I think there's a tremendous amount that we do not understand about the human mind and how it works. That's what I think. Well, there's a tremendous amount we don't understand about the human experience. And, there's definitely some power to be had there. Anyway, Beast, you were saying...
I was actually saying that I have, in fact, I studied Kenpo for about 3 years, so I am familiar with a lot of these ideas. Yeah. Yeah, it was, for me, it was just a way to exercise and get away from my wife. So that's what I did. But I found a lot of the ideas that were held within it to be useful, and I obviously have had some effect on my overall view of things, so.
Yeah, I was who I am right now is tremendously influenced by my years doing Kung Fu. I did it quite seriously, quite often. From the time I was about 11 years old until I was 19, I did it 3 times a week for 3-hour sessions. And, you know, I practiced all the time, and I was like, you know, if anything, a Kung Fu nerd for a while. It definitely refined, like, the way I see the world, the way I think, the way I conduct myself.
You know, honestly, what got me interested in the whole deal, I stopped by this school that was on this road that I frequented. It was a little martial arts school, and I was like, well, you know, I got to do something to get the hell away from my wife or she's going to drive me nuts. So I step in there, and the sensei of the place is there, and he's putting on a lesson, and his lesson is all about his center of gravity. And he challenged all of his students that were in the room to try to take him down, to try to just move him from where he was, using whatever method they felt was necessary. And the dude literally was like a stone. I watched 15 people try everything that you can think of to try to bring this guy down or even move him a few inches from where he was standing. And he was like trying to move a Mack truck, man.
Yeah, you know what? That's very interesting. Like, I remember I was doing... I belonged to a gym where I was doing Muay Thai kickboxing and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Anyway, this guy came into our Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu class, and he did Qigong. And I'm not exactly sure what Qigong is, but this guy was able to, while we were rolling with him and grappling with him, he was able to just dig his finger into random places and paralyze your entire body. It was the fucking most amazing thing I've ever seen.
Right on. So yeah, that I think that's funny in the fact that everything in my life has kind of constantly bounced me back towards studying what's going on in the other world. I mean, so far as even when I heard about this competition for a spot to, you know, take a visit to China in my company. I wrote up an essay that I knew would get me in there. I mean, I memetically programmed that thing from the get-go that they were going to send me. There was just no, you know, there was no other option about it.
Cool, man. That's really cool.
So I know there was one other idea that I really wanted to put out here, because I think that it ties into everything that we've been talking about tonight, and that is the conscious choice of influence, the deciding not only what you will be influenced by, but what influences you will play on other people. I think that this is something that's very neglected, and it's a very left-hand path idea. It's a very taking responsibility for yourself on a larger scale.
Oh, yeah, I think so too. You know, it's very important to identify what exactly is limiting you or what exactly is influencing you, and then choosing, you know, whether or not you want to try to do something about this limit, this limitation or this influence, or whether or not that it's beneficial, which, you know, that's something that people forget. It's oftentimes, you know, these memes that are influencing you are beneficial. They're not always harmful.
Right on. So we got about 4 minutes left. I think it's cool that we slow down the show a little bit. There's a couple of things I wanted to make mention about. One is that this weekend here on the Ooze, we're celebrating the one-year anniversary of Satanic International Network.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Happy birthday, Sin.
That's right. Sin, something that I've been involved in since, I think day one. It's really taken off. It's blossomed in a way that I kind of knew it would when Zach started telling me about his idea. And so it's great to kind of see how it's grown, and we've actually gotten the chance to meet some great folks like Meduse here and you know, yourself, Dan. I don't think you and I would have ever really connected the way we did if we didn't spend endless hours in that chat room on Sin.
Well, the great thing about Sin is that there is this sort of, you know, burgeoning YouTube community of people that were, you know, interested in Satanism and talking about Satanism. And then there was like the old school people that had sort of been around the net forever, you know, on these forums. And Sin is the first time that these two groups really ever came together into one group. And that's is why it's been so successful. It's been drawing so much traffic from Sin or from the YouTube, you know, but it also has all the OGs, if I, you know, I hate to use that term, but, you know, all the people that have been around this this scene for a long time. And I've been around this scene for a long time, you know. Not that I have always been spending as much time as I do on Sin, because Sin is truly one of the better websites or better satanic e-venues of recent memory, that's for sure. And there's never been a chat room as busy under a satanic banner like this in the history of the entire internet that I'm aware of.
Sorry
to interrupt, guys. I've got a client. I got to go. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for calling in, Meduse.
Bye.
All right. And that actually takes me to the last little point that I wanted to hit with the last minute we got left. There has been a video put out recently. In this video, there was a mistaken claim about myself and the people that I associate with, or at least from my perspective. And that claim was that we somehow consider ourselves or profess ourselves to be leaders in this left-hand path community. And I just... I don't want anybody to ever think of me as being somebody who considers myself to be a leader. I would never ask another person to follow me.
I'm with you there. I actively discourage that sort of behavior. What I want, ultimately, is peers. Peers, man. Cultivating peers. That's really the best you can hope for.
Right. And I'm just a little bit different in that I'm more looking for brothers. You know,
yeah, well, on the inside level, there's always the inner circle. But on the outside, you know, the reason that we're addressing the entire internet here and all these people that might be reading is to turn them on to maybe, you know, maybe that's their way of thinking, you know, attract more to this way of thinking, which is personally, you know, just pleasing to me. It's more of an indulgence than anything.
Right on. So with all that being said, bro, I just wanted to kind of put that out there. If there was somebody out there with the misconception that I was some, you know, leader who was going to guide you into some promised future, you're sadly fucking mistaken.
Oh, beast, come on, man. Don't you want to be the high priest of my church? I'll give you virgins, and I don't know, they'll feed you grapes and shit. You gotta shave your head and start working out, though.
Right on, man. But with all that being said and done, dude, we're ready. We're off the air. So.
All right, man. We're done. Good show, man.
Rock on. I'll see you soon.
Thank you for listening to the Ooze. Opinions expressed by our guests or callers do not necessarily represent the opinions held by TC, Zach, Jason, Matt, or any other institution represented by them. If you have been offended by the production of this show, we are sorry, but as the old expression goes, tough luck. Special thanks to Dr. Rocky DeRoma for his contribution to this outro. The Ooze is a Creative Oddity Studios product and is presented by Kikana.